This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July 15th, 2019. Current federal tax developments is brought to you this week by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This week we're going to look at a few developments that took place in areas of federal taxes. We're going to start with the IRS releasing a checklist for tax preparer security. We'll then go on and talk about a taxpayer who was saved by a bookkeeping error in handling a borrowing from her IRA. Taxpayers like to do that. They've read about that on the internet, and obviously anything you read on the internet works just fine. We'll talk about how this taxpayer escaped disaster. We'll also talk about the IRS 31 years after the fact correcting a little miscue that involved when a regulation, the IRS had attempted to fix a typo in a regulation. They actually fixed it. The problem is the never got incorporated in the Code of Federal Regulations, and that creates a problem actually with 163J this year, among a few other things. And then we'll also discuss a set of frequently asked questions the IRS released this week regarding changes that were made to how you handle it in a partnership if there is a donation of an asset that's appreciated in value and the partner in question doesn't have enough basis to absorb their share of the basis of the donated asset. We'll talk about how all of that works this week. So we're going to start out here looking first, talk to you about where I'm going to be here shortly. Next week, in essence next Monday and Tuesday, I will be in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I will be doing a couple of courses there. On the 22nd, I'll be doing a session with dealing with construction contracting. That'll be both a tax and an A&A session. So if you want to sign up for that, that's 8 hours. We talk about both the tax side of the equation, the A&A side, and good news, bad news in construction contracting this year. We have changes going on both, so we'll discuss that in details. Then on Tuesday, I go back to just pure 8 hours of tax, and we'll talk about advanced partnership issues, including the new partnership audit rules, discuss how all of these things work out, what's happening this year, as well as talk about the other advanced issues that hit partnerships. You know, looking at the various things like how we handle special allocations, what exactly it means for something to have substantial economic effect. We'll take a look at contributing appreciated assets to a partnership and the special rules that apply there, and all kinds of other neat little issues that are involved when dealing with partnerships that are beyond the very simple of let's just fill in the K-1. So we'll talk about that again on Tuesday, both of those in Albuquerque, New Mexico this week. So if you're in Albuquerque, you can go ahead and stop on by. We'll see you at those sessions. Okay, next up, let's talk about what's actually going on this week. And what we're going to talk about now is going to be, as I try to update for those of you watching online, trying to update my little screen and having a little fun with it here this week, working with a little different setup. Let's talk about the Taxes Security Together checklist the IRS released. Now, this actually came out a bit earlier in June, but they finally put out a press release on this week. So we'll spend some time talking about this. The IRS wanted to remind everybody that they were going to publish a new checklist for security. This checklist was meant to talk to people about how you're supposed to handle security in your office, what are the big problems facing us in security, and essentially remind us that we have responsibilities in that area. This checklist includes required steps for those preparing tax returns. If you prepare returns in your office, there are required security steps you're mandated to take under the law. This particular rule takes a look at that, and you know, we kind of looks at some of the things you should be worrying about. If you go actually looking for the checklist separately, as far as I can tell, it doesn't exist separately. But what exists is in news releases, they actually give you all the details of what they call their checklist. So if you're looking for something you're going to download that simply says checklist, it's a PDF, has little boxes to fill in, not going to find that. Rather, you've got this thing here. So let's talk about what's involved here. Well, the IRS first starts out and tells you that you want to deploy what they call the Security 6. And these are six steps they say you should take right away. The first step they say, which is probably the least effective, I know it's going to surprise some people, but to be totally honest, it's important, but it's not going to stop anybody who's currently trying to attack you, is to put in antivirus software. Antivirus software, I think I've discussed this before with people online, it's necessary, but it by definition is reactive. And what's happening is when people are trying to find ways around your systems, trying to get you to do things, first thing is if they need to infect your system, which some cases here they don't need to, but if they need to infect your system, what they're going to end up doing is testing their way of infecting and installing things in your system against the major antivirus software. There are actually services you can buy. Talk about an interesting business. And then I say interesting in quotes. Legality is a huge problem, but aside from that, that you can sign up for a service if you're a software publisher in this area. Also weird calling them software publishers, where effectively your exploits are updated and they're constantly checked against all the major antivirus software. So what the antivirus software mainly does is protect you against old attacks. And that's not totally worthless because old attacks float around. And if they get in, fine, they work. But it's not going to stop anything likely popping in your email box this week. And that's going to be a problem. Second thing, also important, but not necessarily enough to stop everything, is to use a firewall. Again, a firewall makes it difficult for something just trying to attack your system from the outside to get in. So if they're scanning the net, they're looking for things, it won't be there. By the way, a little caveat I put next to this, almost every time we have a firewall, we can open holes in the firewall. Be very, very, very careful about opening holes, especially for remote access. Hate to say it, but remote access bugs are exploited, and those are like the perfect situation to take advantage of. So be careful. Remote access is probably should always be done via a VPN or some other method of securing the access. Should not just be done by putting Windows Remote Desktop and punching a hole through the firewall. That's a real problem. We've had some recent major problems with that, where it turns out there were major issues that allowed people to exploit systems if they expose Windows, if they expose an unpatched version of the Windows Remote Desktop. So just be careful what you expose through a firewall. A firewall is great, but if you're punching holes in it, every hole is an exploit. The key thing to remember is, though, in most cases, how people are getting in these days is they're coming in with permission. Now, you may not realize what you gave permission for, but they're getting permission in some form. One key thing to use, because stealing authentication, getting in, logging into remote systems, logging into your network, is something that these people try to do. And I mean, that's the easiest way in, come in authenticated, then don't worry about the antivirus or the firewall. We're perfectly set up. We're just in and running. Use two-factor authentication where possible. If you're not aware of what two-factor authentication is, it means you have your username, your password, and then you need something else that they can't easily get from you online, something that changes constantly. This could be very, very, very poor security in this area, but still a lot better than without, is using an SMS code to your phone. I strongly suggest if you have any option aside from that, you don't do that. If you want to know why not to do that, you can look up what's called SIM hijacking. There are ways, if somebody really wants in your system and you're using an SMS code, that they could get the SMS code and get in. They still need your username and password, but it's there. Better is to use an authenticator app. Best known authenticator is Google Authenticator. There are lots of others. They all pretty much work on the same structure. So hopefully you're using two-factor authentication. Everywhere you can, you should use 2FA. The best system for two-factor authentication, if your system supports it, are hardware keys like the YubiKey or the Titan from Google. Preferably hardware, not Bluetooth, but you can use Bluetooth. Bluetooth still probably better than the alternatives. The hardware keys are even better because there's no way they get duplicated or taken over. You need the actual physical key with you. But it's another factor to get in. So if somebody gets a username and password, they still can't get in the system. By the way, the other problem with two-factor authentication, if you're using it, watch carefully. What happens if you lose your password? Or what happens if I say I lost my authenticator? The problem with this, too often the system set up two-factor authentication, but then they have recovery mechanisms because we want to be customer friendly in case they lose their authenticator. Great. Except if how they get you back in is totally bypasses a two-factor authentication, it's not worth a whole lot. Somebody can get in. So you'd prefer to have very strong two-factor authentication, and you'd prefer to be, quite honestly, just simply out of luck if you lose it. You know, it's not quite that way. It means you have multiple keys and you make sure you know where they are. You may have an authenticator. I, again, would not use SMS as a backup unless there's no other reasonable way to do it. The fourth way, make sure you back up your software and services. Use backup software and services. That's really important because some of the ways we lose things is if your system goes down, that really fouls up clients, and that's a security issue, availability security. Make sure your systems are backed up. Make sure your systems are, you know, constantly being backed up. There's off-site backups. This also is incredibly important in case of a ransomware attack. The best way to deal with ransomware is to be able to find a backup that is not infected and use that backup to restore the system. If you don't have that, it's a lot tougher to recover from ransomware. That's why it would be really, really important to find these backups and keep them. Make sure you encrypt all hard drives. That should be the ones in your office in addition to the ones on the laptops, absolutely the ones on the laptops. Full drive encryption is available in Windows Professional. If you don't have Pro, this is a reason to get it. It's a $100 upgrade, and $100 is worth not. By the way, if your laptop stolen, which contains the drive, you're going to have to assume that all data on it has been accessed by third parties, and that's going to cost you way more than $100. So I strongly suggest get full drive encryption, get it going, Windows Pro. If you're running Windows Home, now, today, drop what you're doing. Go get Windows Pro. Windows Pro. Now, this will be versions. I think you've got to be on version 8 or later for Pro to work. Anyway, you can't really upgrade to Pro on 7. If you've been delaying upgrading from 7 and you're not encrypted, find a third-party encryption or upgrade to 10 right now, because not having an encrypted drive is just going to cost you a fortune if that drive is ever lost or stolen. And also create and secure VPNs. As I mentioned before, virtual private networks are what you should be using in order to do any remote tunneling into your system, either that or an encrypted service that can let you in the system. But again, then your problem is if you use a third-party service, like let's say you are using, GoToMyPC, that's great, except, of course, if you haven't secured that way in down well enough, you know, or if they have some issue, and if you don't use third-party authentication with it, you've opened a hole. So a really good, solidly secured VPN using certificates on the remote machines is by far the best way to handle that for remote access. It's a mess. Yes, it's messy to set up. That's why you have to probably bring somebody in. But those are very useful things to get started. The IRS reminds you, you need to create a data security plan that is mandated by federal law. Everybody who does tax returns is supposed to have a written security plan. The requirements are relatively flexible. You just have to tell us what you're doing, how you're protecting data, what steps you're taking. It's really the thought process that's going to be key here, right? You want to focus on training employees, how you deal with managing what employees can do. Do people have access to things they shouldn't have access to? And then number two, training them, letting them understand the most likely way into your system is through your employees. That's how the attacks, 9 out of 10 attacks are going to come through an employee opening the door and doing so without knowing they're doing so. You've got to train your employees on how they're going to be approached, the attacks are going to happen, and what to do and not to do. Focus on looking at your information systems, how they're set up. Where is data? How is it exposed? We're seeing a lot of problems as data gets moved to the cloud, and people just aren't even thinking about how they lock things down when they move to the cloud. In fact, in some ways, they're opening it up just because, they had an error, so they opened it up to let them get access, not realizing you have an open bucket on Amazon Web Services, which, by the way, you pretty much have to work to open it up to the public, but we're seeing these all over the place because it fixes a problem, I'm sure. You know, be careful, understand how that goes. And also, how do you detect and manage failures when things get in your system? Do you check for things? Do you look for things that suggest maybe there's something going on with your system? Make sure everybody in your office understands phishing scams. There are a lot of what's called spear phishing. They're aimed at CPAs and accountants. You're going to see things come out that are going to tell you you've got to renew your P10. Let's say your P10 has been suspended. Your e-file account, electronic filing account, has been suspended. You're subject to a state board investigation. We're going to have various ways of targeting you to get you to respond. You know, we have issues with your account, at your tax software vendor. Please log in, so that we can help you and assist you. Be very, very careful. Those things, trying to get data. Sometimes it'll be customized down to the firm itself. The larger your firm is, the more likely that's true. Other times they're just going to be generic because, you know what? If I spew out an email telling everybody, send every CPA I can find an email saying, oh, by the way, your ProSystem FX online e-filing account is going to be suspended in 24 hours unless you log in and give us some additional information. Most of you probably don't use ProSystem FX, but a good chunk of you do. And I just need to get, so I'm going to have a good chunk it'll work for. And I just need a few of those to panic and jump in. And that's the sort of thing that will come down in spear phishing. Beware of ransomware. We're seeing, there have been a slew of cities in Florida recently that have been hit with ransomware attacks. Ransomware is going to encrypt the drive, is then going to try to turn around and ask you for money to decrypt your drive. The bad news is, when this gets in, we got one other problem. Somebody's been in your system. They've been working with your data. You don't really have any way of knowing that data hasn't left the drive. Be very, very leery. Understand, ransomware tends to come in via attachments that people run. They love using Office formats, Microsoft Office format documents, and have people trick them into turning on, turning on macros and other things. Microsoft, when it says if something came from the web, they've got this, you can't edit. This is read-only. Click here if you need to edit. They trick you into turning on to edit, to turn on the macros, which then allows them to plant their ransomware attack. So be very, very careful of that. Microsoft Office documents are the way they love to send this stuff in. It's not the only way. PDFs will be used too. But Office gives them a lot of options, and it still drives me batty when people send Office documents as attachments. In 99 times out of 100, there is no reason for an editable document to be in that email. But we send it because it's easy. Microsoft put that little, send with Outlook on there. Be careful. And if you get one, assume it's infected until you confirm you really should have gotten an editable Office document. And certainly don't click the little button to allow macros, to turn on editing. Just do something else with it. My own take, to be totally honest, is I would install something like OpenOffice. Not OpenOffice anymore. It's now LibreOffice, the one being maintained. LibreOffice, and just have it open the Word documents. If it comes over the internet, we can't figure out what's up there. Their macro language doesn't work like this. It's very different. But basically, be very, very careful of giving something to Word or Excel. Learn the signs of client data theft, not death, but data theft. Clients receive IRS letters about suspicious tax returns. That could be a bunch. If you've got, if you suddenly get this week phone calls from 14 clients on Monday that said they all got this letter from the IRS, that's a potential problem. Have you checked your EFIN? How many tax returns were filed under your EFIN number? Do you check it during tax season? If you suddenly have 12,000 returns filed using your EFIN number, that suggests a problem. But it's probably not going to be that blatant because the IRS probably catch that. But if you've only had 20 returns come in the office very early in tax season, and you go in and you see 200 have been filed via EFIN this week, that's a scan. That's a sign to you that you've got a problem. There's something going on in your systems. Okay. If the clients received tax transcripts they didn't request, that's a key issue. Make sure you have a recovery plan for data theft. The bad news is these days, a lot of advisors will tell you it's not a question of if, but when. If you have it, they tell you to contact the IRS stakeholder liaison. I will tell you to immediately contact legal counsel and then contact the IRS. Then under them, you'll contact the various parties here. But this is going to be a major issue. You've got to assist the IRS in protecting clients. By the way, there are legal responsibilities here. You can't delay this stuff. So you have very legal, very much heavy duty legal exposure. It will only get worse the longer it takes to get notices out. So like it or not, you're going down this path. you got to contact cybersecurity professionals to try to figure out how to stop the thefts. These are all things that we're going to be looking at. Again, this checklist, nothing new really on it, but it is something to consider. And now, especially here in the downtime, until we get to next tax season, ramping up full speed, or even when we get to the extension period, really ramping up full speed. We're still here in July, and we know that our clients with September due dates aren't even thinking about that issue yet. So think about getting this stuff together here in the down period. Okay, let's go to our regular stuff. First thing is a bookkeeping error, Brack versus Commissioner, Tax Memorandum, 2019-83, issued on July the 8th, 2019. Taxpayers have read on the internet, and of course we all know that everything on the internet is correct, that it's great. The greatest thing one can do is take advantage of this loophole that lets you borrow money from your IRA. And you can do that for anything. And so they've read that. Well, a couple of caveats about that. First thing is, I always think it's a dumb idea. But even if I didn't say it's just a dumb idea, and it's a dumb idea because how things can go wrong. You have to realize that the IRS agrees that Congress allows you to do this. But the IRS also agrees that it's pretty clear Congress didn't mean for this to be used for borrowing. They meant for it to be used to allow you to move funds from one IRA account to another. Because of that, the IRS says, obviously, we have to let you do this. You could take $200,000 out of your IRA, and you can, as long as it goes back in within 60 days and you don't do this again for a year, we're fine. But if you come in on day 61, generally we're in trouble. There are ways to get relief, but if the reason you come on day 61 is, oh, I forgot, oh, dang it, I didn't realize that was the day of, I somehow fouled up my counting, tough luck. And in this particular case, here's what happened. The taxpayer was trying to buy a new home, right? Well, she needed a bit of cash to do it, like $500,000. So she decided her new home was closing in Philadelphia. She hadn't yet got her old home sold. They were working on the process of it, but the closing hadn't happened. So she takes $500,000 from her IRA and uses that money to allow her to close on the purchase of the home in Philadelphia. Okay, that's fine. So she takes the money out, it's going to do this. Now, basically, 57 days after the original distribution, the sale closes, and she receives funds from the sale of her old home on day 58. It's a Thursday, right? So that comes out. She now has the check. She's ready to redeposit the check. Now, here's what's kind of interesting about her structure, okay? And we see this a lot. How many of you have a client, you have like a client who uses a local brokerage, a local financial advisor, and the local brokerage, local financial advisor produces statements, and those statements look a lot like statements from other local advisors and local financial professionals, right? I mean, it has their logo on it. It has their name on it. But you always notice on the top that it tells you that, essentially Pershing is handling the actual, all of the processing for this account. And obviously handling things like statements and the like. Well, she was involved with basically a broker like that. That broker worked through Pershing. Now, Pershing, her broker, her advisor, told her that she should take this money and she should basically take it and give it to Pershing, because the IRA, she has an IRA with this brokerage firm that's using Pershing. Pershing is the one that is, basically really holding the IRA per se. And the 1099 is going to be issued under Pershing's name. Well, that's kind of a mess. She doesn't really want to go down there and do the work and have to deal with them. Who's Pershing? She's never dealt with them. She doesn't have any idea what it is. Can't she just send it to the broker? Now remember, this is on day 58 of Friday. They finally decide that she could send it to them. So she overnights it to them there in North Carolina. They get it on Monday. Okay, now Monday's day 61. But that's still okay. The money could have gone in that day. But they then have to get the funds on to Pershing, and it shows up on their statement on day 62. So on day 62, it shows up as deposited in the IRA. The IRS says, wait a minute, she's late. It didn't get in until day 62. And one of the IRS's key attacks on this was that she did not give it to the IRA custodian. That this brokerage firm, you know, this local investment advisory group, was not the actual custodian of the account. Rather, the custodian was Pershing. And the money was not presented to Pershing until day 62. So she's too late. The IRS wants tax on $500,000. The tax court. Now, this is kind of interesting because the tax court actually went back and took a look at an old case that we saw from the Ninth Circuit 1989 called Wood versus Commissioner. Wood was an interesting case because Wood was the first taxpayer that we know of, at least the first one in court, that was able to get an IRA rollover past the 60th day because he had actually presented funds to Merrill Lynch. They put it in the wrong account because they didn't follow instructions and didn't notice the problem until past the 60th day. In that case, the tax court and the Ninth Circuit agreed that Wood, and I think it was the Ninth Circuit, I've got to double check that. I know it's a tax court case. The tax court ruled that, you know, that was a mere bookkeeping error. Had the custodian followed the instructions, it would have been back in the IRA, so it counts as going in within 60 days. The tax court in this case decided that this was very, very similar. The one key problem that bothers me a bit about this case was the court based this on because it said, look, you know, IRS, you're claiming that Pershing is really the custodian. Court kind of said it's not clear the relationship of Pershing and this other organization, this firm in North Carolina. They're both on the statements. The statements come from them. It's not really clear. And the court actually resolved that in the taxpayer's favor. The court decided that, essentially, you know, that, oh, well, I guess they're the custodian, too. That's a little concerning because it suggests that had the IRS presented evidence that, in fact, the only real custodian that was qualified was Pershing, that could be a problem. You know, we may have a little issue there. We'll have to see. I'm a little concerned about how the court dealt with that, never really held that the North Carolina entity was actually a custodian. An arrangement like this works. They just said, well, you know, close enough. It's good enough. We'll go with that. But they said it's mere bookkeeping. They also said, look, IRS, even if Wood wasn't there, your prior revenue procedure that came out, this one actually predates the most recent one, because we have one now, it's automatic, but Revenue Procedure 2003-16 pretty much says that you always got automatic relief if the funds were deposited into an eligible retirement account within 1 year of when the 60-day period, you know, began, and if they had followed, if the financial institution had followed the instructions they'd received, it would have been in deposit in time. They said, you know, that this meets that too. Takeaway from this, this was a close call. Very close call. I advise you to tell taxpayers not to do this, but it does tell us also, it tells us probably, at least until we get some more guidance in this area, to be nervous about those accounts where you've got a front-end name, but then it's clear it's being processed by another party. You know, you see these, a lot of services offer this, so you've seen these before, where it all seems to be the same entity in the back end doing it, but there's a different front-end service, smaller firms use this. Yeah, be careful on those. Make sure you insure, tell the taxpayer, insure it gets to, in this case, Pershing, by the 60th day. You know, we need to be concerned about that because the IRS could very well read this case and decide, well, next time we're just going to go subpoena information about the relationship between that entity and Pershing and show Pershing's really the custodian. Well, better late than never. This was interesting. Tax Basic Treasury Decision 8179, issued on July the 11th. This is a correction to, actually just a republication of a typo correction from 1988. Here's the catch. The IRS issued Regulation 1.52-1D1I with a typo. Now, you know, you may wonder, look, I mean, that's like work opportunity credit. I don't really have anybody with it. Why do I care? We care because this thing's cross-referenced constantly. And what it did, they put a correction in the Federal Register 2 months later to deal with this problem that they had. The correction never made it into the CFR. And this is important, though. Why? Because Section 52, this is the section dealing with when entities that are not incorporated are related enough to have to be combined for certain purposes, one of which is computing the $25 million limitation for various things under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, like being on the cash basis of accounting, you know, getting out of 263 Cap A, not having to keep inventories, being a small contractor. Oh, and by the way, 163J for interest expense. Now, here's the catch. Tony Nitti, back in March, did an article because he was researching this and he started following things up and he noticed something weird. This regulation was worded two different ways. He had a printed copy of the Code of Federal Regulations from CCH from 2012. That Code of Federal Regulations said you cross-reference for these related entities, you know, to determine related entities if at least one of them is not a corporation. You went back and took a look at Regulation 1.414C-4, okay? And that's all well and good, except then Tony noticed, got online, again from CCH. And in the online version of this that you'll see if you looked at it today, well, maybe not now, hopefully now things have been changed, but you would have said, it said Regulation 1.414C-4, but then after it said B1. Now, that's important because that regulation 1.414C1, is a list of basically all various types of related parties. By limiting it to B1, Tony notes that we had actually done this so the only way a non-corporate entity could be related to corporate entities is if there was an option to buy into it. If you actually owned it, or, you know, let's say if your spouse actually owned the shares, your kids actually owned the shares, your corporation owned the shares. Well, that wasn't necessarily related. So if your corporation you didn't own a majority interest in owned the shares, you were still good. And it was like, wait a minute, that seems to be a problem. Well, the IRS noticed it. What happened was, the IRS went back and finally figured out what happened. Because Tony asked CCH what happened. CCH, as the person at CCH went and researched it, discovered that they had been using the first version. But then somebody, a number of years later, had called them and said, wait, no, this Code of Federal Regulations shows it like this. They discovered, yeah, the official CFR showed it the other way with B1, so they updated. But it turns out the real problem was the Code of Federal Regulations was never updated for what was published in the Federal Register. Well, the IRS now has re-released the typo fix, but that creates a problem. Which one do you use? The IRS is now going to tell us that they will accept either view, either position with regard to what's a related group for any tax year beginning before 2019. Why is this before, I should say, that begins before July 11th of 2019. Why is that important? Because that means that 163J rules can be interpreted under the old rule, which means effectively it's highly unlikely that an unincorporated group, unless it comes in via their other mechanisms where they're service organizations, but if it has to come in via the Code Section 52 method of being related parties, likelihood is it's not going to be related until 2020. That's an interesting problem. And by the way, somebody else on Twitter, in response to when I tweeted out this article, you know, noted that they had taken a look. They found five other circumstances where the CFR didn't get updated for a correction that was in the Federal Register. Most of those, I suspect, aren't nearly as significant as this. This one was significant. But if you have 163J issues and you have unincorporated entities, take a look at this article that I've written this week. Take a look at Tony's article. Take a look at what's happened since then. It's important. We also had then finally the IRS put out a question and answer, frequently asked questions, on the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act changes to charitable contribution and foreign taxes. And they're changing the rules under 704D. 704D's rules deal with the limitations on a taxpayer getting a tax benefit if they've run out of basis in their partnership interest. Now, what happens in this case is we're looking at contributions, charitable contributions of appreciated assets and foreign taxes. Now, the frequently asked question, the foreign tax one's not that difficult. What happened in the past, if you had like $10,000 of foreign taxes that's coming out as a foreign tax credit, you have no basis in your partnership interest. Up until the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you were able to claim that credit on $10,000 paid. You didn't need to have basis in order to claim that benefit, right? The foreign taxes ignored that. They were not limited by basis. Charities were a little different. If I give appreciated property, that also does not affect, I'm not limited by my basis. So let's say my base of my interest is $10,000. We give charitable property that the cost $10,000 apart, that let's say my share of what's cost is $10,000 at the partnership level, and it's actually worth $100,000. I can still claim $100,000 deduction. And that's true even after TCJA. But here's the catch. What if I didn't have $10,000, an amount equal to the basis in the property that's being contributed, but my basis was only $5,000 when that was contributed? So I have $5,000 of basis. My share of the contributed property is $10,000. Under the old law, I still get the $100,000 deduction. Under the law as changed with charitable contributions, now I'm only going to get half of that. The other half, the half of the appreciation is going to tie dollar for dollar to the basis of the property. And until I have enough basis to take the basis charge, I can't claim that much of the charitable contribution. So as I said, my example, $10,000 worth of basis in the asset that's allocable to me that was contributed. I only have $5,000 of basis in my interest before this contribution. I'm only going to get $50,000 deduction. The other $50,000 will carry forward. If I get $5,000 of basis in the future that allows me to take the rest of the $5,000, then I can take the other $50,000 of deduction. So, you know, these rules, this is how the IRS interpreted the rules. They were effective for 18. They're effective 18 and forward. This is how the IRS says those partnership rules work. So we have all the examples are in the frequently asked questions. They're on in our articles. Remember, you can download the articles on our website. Well, we're in the middle of the summer. It is definitely time if you want to start thinking about your continuing education for this year. You want to pick up some during the summer. Go ahead, take a look what we're offering. I realize we're heading into kind of the downtime. But, you know, July and August is a good time to pick up these live courses because things are a little quieter. Come September, you know everything's going to ramp up. From September 1st to October 15th, you're not really be able to do a whole lot. You understand that. We've got deadline after deadline after deadline in that time period. But go ahead, take the courses, take a look at what's out there. And as I said, I'm going to be presenting courses in Albuquerque. I'll have courses coming up in Arizona and South Dakota in August. We have courses all over the country with Kaplan. Your state societies are running courses. So check what's available, see what you can sign up for. And, you know, we look forward to hearing from you at those courses. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments. You can catch our updates at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You know, we'll post there when things happen during the week. I try to post updates there so you can find things as they go on. You can send any questions or comments to me at my email address, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. On Twitter, that's @edzollers. And I also follow discussions, as I said. I follow the state societies of New Jersey, Minnesota, my home society of Arizona. I follow them on their Connect group, so if you want to post some things there, if I see it and I think I can help, I'll try to say something there. I also try to look in from time to time on Cal CPA's Tax Talk group. That is open to anybody around the country that wants to log in there. Also follow me on Reddit. I do check into the Tax Pros subreddit there, /r/taxpros. You can find that stuff on Reddit. So you can check in there. And otherwise, it's going to be another week. We're heading into late July. We'll see if Congress does anything before they leave for August recess. That could get interesting. We'll see what goes on. Otherwise, we'll see what IRS gives out. Again, August tends to be more of a dead month. That doesn't always true, especially this year with a lot of guidance that the IRS still has to get out. May not be quite as dead as it's been in the past, but we'll keep up on what's happening. And so join us back here next week for current federal tax development.